Hello, and welcome to the Degree of Freedom podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber, and last week I started to run down some of the things I learned as part of my Degree of Freedom one-year BA project that might be useful to students thinking about taking one or more MOOCs, professors or schools considering whether they should get into the MOOC game, and educational policymakers and others curious as to how MOOCs stack up when compared to other forms of teaching and learning. Last week, I focused on individual massive online classes, what worked, what didn't, how they compared to one another, and how they compared to equivalent classes taken at a residential college or university. But today, I'd like to look at the degree of freedom experience as a whole to see if there's an answer to the question I posed when this project began. Is it possible to learn the equivalent of what you get from a four-year BA in just 12 months using only MOOCs and other forms of free learning? In a way, this question is less urgent now than it was when I first posed it. For a year ago, policymakers, the press, and the public couldn't take their eyes off those huge enrollment numbers associated with the many MOOCs coming off the conveyor belt, which opened up interest in a mode of learning that seemed to be teaching more students every few months than the entire Ivy League does every few years. The fact that it was these very Ivy League colleges that were both producing massive courses and celebrating their educational value and rigor, which triggered obvious next questions regarding whether such tools could be used as a substitute for the $250,000 residential programs to which these same schools were continuing to assign unique value. But as time went on, we learned a little bit more about what MOOC enrollees were doing beyond signing up for a course and either finishing it or not finishing it. Those 100,000-plus enrollments began to look less meaningful. For at least half the people hitting the enroll button seemed to be doing so just to browse a syllabus, take a closer look at a professor, or simply sign up to get something of value for nothing. And of the tens of thousands who remained, a majority seemed interested in just auditing a course by going through the video lectures. In fact, even the most popular MOOC classes seemed to contain fewer than 10,000 students who had demonstrated an interest in taking the course to completion, and among those, about half seemed able to get to the finish line and earn a certificate. Now, we should not poo-poo a learning tool that allows a professor to teach more people in one semester than they have in their entire teaching career, but at the same time, those real numbers begin to explain why MOOCs look less like a logical substitute for traditional college in 2014 than they seemed at the start of 2013. Digging into the numbers still further, the majority of MOOC students seem to look a lot more like MOOC instructors in terms of age and education level than their residential classroom students. I've seen figures that say up to 75 to 80% of any MOOC class is made up of students over the age of 25 with at least one degree. While 25% of thousands is still a significant figure, even if we stop talking about huge enrollments and just think in terms of big ones, the vast majority of people taking massive open classes don't seem to fall into the category of someone looking for a low-cost alternative to a traditional college education. We also have results of a few experiments designed to see if younger people engaged in MOOC learning are actually interested in gaining no or low-cost credit for the experience. For example, the MOOC provider Udacity struck a deal with the University of Colorado that allowed students there to receive full credit for taking a Udacity MOOC on computer programming for completing the online class and paying an $89 processing fee, versus the $1,000 or more one would need to pay to take a live class on the same subject. So how many students signed up to earn a credit for such a pittance? Can you say empty set? Similarly, both Udacity and Coursera put a number of their classes through the accreditation process via the American Council of Education, or ACE. I actually put a curriculum and associated certification exam through ACE accreditation process many years ago, and can attest to its rigor. A team of experts worked on site with us for several days, finally deciding on what number of credit hours would be associated with the credit recommendation they gave our program. The term recommendation is critical here, since ACE does not award credit but simply makes recommendations, which the thousands of colleges and universities which compose the membership of the organization are free to accept, ignore, or modify. And turning an alternative learning method, of which there are many, into college credit is neither simple nor free. First, students need to pass the course. Then they have to receive a transcript from the American Council of Education, which comes with a fee. Then they have to take that transcript to their school, which may or may not accept it, and may not even be familiar with the program a student went through, requiring the student to sell their alternative learning experience to the university. Many schools limit the number of credits from outside institutions that will count towards graduation, and even if they accept those credit-bearing alternatives, there's usually student fees attached to doing so. Even so, ACE-accredited MOOC courses provide a mechanism for students to obtain credit for pennies on the dollar compared to the cost of taking similar classes at a residential school. which makes it all the more curious why the number of takers for such cheap college credit also stood at zero at the end of last year. Now, it may very well take time for something as new as MOOCs to develop the reputation and infrastructure needed to establish them as a mainstream credit alternative, similar to successful alternative credit programs such as AP or CLEP. But at the very least, I think it's fair to say that whatever MOOCs are, they're not about to shake the traditional higher education system to rubble over the next few months, or even the next several years, if ever. That said, they do have the potential to do their disruptive work at a slower pace and a lower decibel level. But with regard to offering a disruptive alternative to the traditional college cohort of 18 to 22-year-olds, the original question I started with remains. Can MOOCs provide the teaching power to allow students to learn what they would in a four-year BA program in less time for less money? Over the course of this year, I heard of or from a number of students who took even more classes than I had, which was pretty impressive. But I think I was the only extreme learner who based his program on formal degree requirements, including distribution and major requirements, all to see how MOOC stacked up to a more conventional approach to obtaining a BA. As most of you know, my major was in philosophy. As my project came to an end, that philosophical training prompted me to create arguments on both sides of the question of whether or not a MOOC BA could be the equivalent of a brick-and-mortar one. Those of you who read the blog will have heard these arguments before, but given that they represent my best shot at a distillation of what a one-year BA adds up to, I've decided to repeat the bulk of them out loud. So let me start with the prosecution. After coming up with the idea of a one-year BA, the next step was to calculate whether it was even possible to fit 30-plus MOOC and other free learning courses that would meet the degree requirements of a liberal arts college or university into a 12-month time frame. There are a fair number of MOOCs available at the start of 2013, which clearly spelled out the number of weeks and hours per week required for each course. And while there was not enough MOOC content to fulfill all the distribution and major requirements equivalent to a BA at that time, it looked like the ability to leverage other college-level free learning resources and the flexibility to fit study hours into any time of the day meant there would be enough hours in the year to make this work. At the same time, I did a less rigorous calculation to see if it was theoretically possible to cram 4 years of college into one if I enrolled in a traditional residential school, which would involve taking classes at three times the normal pace for a matriculated student, assuming classes would go on all year, including during the summer. Unsurprisingly, no school calendar I could find would allow someone to fit this many classes into such a short time period. But more importantly for this discussion, having gone through a traditional four-year college degree program a while back, it was clear to me that even if scheduling were not a problem, trying to fit 32 semester-long brick-and-mortar college classes into 12 months would not be possible, given the workload of courses created by professors who assume their students are each taking no more than 4 to 5 classes at a time. By this logic, then, the reason a one-year MOOC BA could work while a one-year residential BA would probably not is because, on average, MOOC classes make fewer demands on students than do their residential equivalents. Now, that on average is an important point, since as I noted last week, I can think of several classes I've taken this year, including edX's Ancient Greek Hero, Science and Cooking in China X, Coursera's Think Again, and the Modern and the Postmodern, and Udacity's Intro to Statistics and Psychology that clearly model themselves on traditional semester-long courses. And while other classes varied in terms of scope and rigor, the ones that were not modeled on existing semester-long courses were all less demanding on student time and brain power than were courses deliberately designed to mimic residential equivalents. In some cases, this was because professors, freed from the tyranny of the semester system, were able to focus on just a single topic they loved to teach. Many of my favorite humanities and social science courses, such as Coursera's Property and Liability, Fall and Rise of Jerusalem, and Kierkegaard classes, fell into this category. Some classes were lecture-only, a topic I've taken up on the blog, so I won't repeat those arguments here. And in a few cases, such as edX's Justice or Saylor's Existentialism class, the course went on for the number of weeks you'd expect for a full semester course, but the level of demand placed on students who were only asked to pass a few relatively easy multiple-choice quizzes created a contrast between the heft of the material being taught and the lightness of what students were asked to do with what they had been studying. In fact, putting learning to work represented a whole category where MOOCs seemed less demanding than the classroom courses I remember from long ago. Even having gone the extra step of doing both required and optional work in classes like Coursera's Einstein and Relativity, I probably ended up writing fewer than a dozen papers during my one-year degree program. And as I've complained about on several occasions, assessment, whether it's part of weekly quizzes or final exams, was pretty light across the board in almost all the courses I took. So if you're asking me if the work I put in the last 12 months is equivalent to the amount I put into 4 years of residential college back in the 1980s, the answer would have to be no. But this brings up the question of whether the learning that goes on at either a residential college or through an online equivalent requires that every class be packaged into a 12 to 14 week semester with a specific number of lectures per week coupled with a specific number of papers, tests, and other assignments in order to be considered legitimate. For instance, would I know that much more about Kierkegaard's relation to Socrates had I written two 2,000-word papers on the topic versus just one? Is my grasp of what Michael Sandel taught so well in his Justice course diminished by the fact that I had to create my own level of rigor by writing short essays for the weekly required comments to make up for the fact that the course did not include a graded writing component? In short, even if my one-year BA didn't require me to spend as much time on each individual class as I had in order to earn my original four-year degree, does that necessarily mean I learned less in the process? Which leads me to the defense. And before beginning an argument that says taking 32-plus online courses in 12 months might be the equivalent of a four-year BA's worth of learning, I'd like to first ask listeners to take a blank sheet of paper and write down the name of every course you took while in college. Depending on your age and memory, or lack thereof, you probably came up with rough names of about half to two-thirds of those courses you once sweated over. And speaking of sweat, what might happen if I now ask you to retake the final exam from one of those classes? Let's say the same final you passed with flying colors when you first took the course. If visions of panic and Fs are flashing through your head, does that indicate you really didn't learn anything in those courses you spent so much money to have access to and so much time and effort to pass? Probably not, since if you had a week to prepare for that test or to write a paper summarizing the key points in a class, you could probably brush up on the material, drawing from sources now widely available on the internet and synthesizing that content with an a priori understanding of key concepts you developed when you first took the course. Having studied chemistry, I was trained to think like a chemist, and as part of that training as a scientist, just as someone who studied history as an undergraduate trained themselves to think like an historian. And for anyone now working in the field they study while in college, the specifics they learned are probably ready to hand, especially if they've been put to work on a regular basis since graduation. This thought experiment is meant to point out the irony inherent in the fact that while we think we know a great deal because of our college degree, when it comes right down to it, we really know nothing. Which means that as we evaluate not just MOOCs, but any alternative form of higher education, we need to compare them to a residential college experience whose main intellectual benefit was not the classes we took or assignments we performed, most of which we could barely remember, but what that experience turned us into. So rather than evaluate my one-year BA experience based on the length and rigor of the courses I completed, as I just did in the prosecution statement, what would happen if we instead looked at the transformative effects studying a degree worth of material might have had on this student? As a philosophy major, I now have enough of a grasp on modern philosophical concepts such as a priori knowledge, from Kant, ready to hand, via Heidegger, and irony, thanks to Kierkegaard, to make use of them in the analysis you've just been listening to. And these and other subjects, about which I knew nothing 12 months ago, have been internalized to the point where they can be applied to the key subject of my degree of freedom project, MOOCs and Free Learning, which have been analyzed through the lens of Kantian, utilitarian, and pragmatic philosophy, not to mention economics and even entropy. Now, the ability to use philosophical ideas in such a way hardly makes me a philosopher. But I do think it's fair to consider myself the equivalent of a graduating senior with a BA in philosophy who's now capable of applying important philosophical principles to different subjects and different aspects of life. And since many college grads move into fields they didn't study as an undergrad, this means the primary benefit they got out of college was the ability to apply rigorous thinking they developed by studying a certain discipline to other categories of activity. So if you think of a college experience not in terms of what you do, but rather what you become, then how far-fetched is it to say my one-year BA was equivalent of a four-year one? Okay, moving on from that clip show, in order to put the defense argument I just presented to the test, I decided to subject my entire program to a final exam by crashing the 2013 Eastern Division Conference of the American Philosophical Association, or APA. That event was held in Baltimore between Christmas and New Year's, and I traveled down there with a friend who actually is a philosopher, having taught a number of colleges and written several books on the subject. He prepared me for what I could expect at the many sessions that occurred at APA, as well as at the Saturday night evening party, still charmingly referred to as a smoker. I decided to sit in a number of sessions, including one on Kant's political philosophy and Locke's metaphysics. I had actually studied Locke's political philosophy and Kant's metaphysics during my one-year BA program, which meant I was familiar with the philosophers being discussed, but not the particular philosophies. And my test would be a simple one, whether or not I felt like an ignoramus, in way over my head when hanging out with a hotel full of PhDs who had dedicated their lives to a subject I had only studied for one intense year. And I'm happy to report that I actually understood what everyone was talking about. In fact, a keynote event, which focused on a group of thinkers I had never heard of before, was completely accessible thanks to the learning I had obtained during my one-year BA project, especially a self-study course I took on the Philosophical School of Pragmatism. In fact, at the one session I attended that did talk about a specific subject I had studied in a MOOC class, a moral dilemma called the trolley problem, introduced to me in Michael Sandel's edX Justice course, I was actually able to not just follow along with a visiting scholar's argument that Kant provides a solution to this vexing thought experiment, but actually raised a question that, while slapped down, was no better or worse than the questions being bandied about by the professional philosophers, including Kant scholars in the room. Now keep in mind that all of these subjects, Kant, Locke, pragmatism, were ones I knew next to nothing about a year ago. So again, if education is measured in outcomes versus inputs, how much distance should we put between my one-year MOOC BA and what someone might get out of a four-year residential one? Getting back to an argument readers will have heard before, the most significant objection to my defense would highlight the fact that my previous residential college experience very likely provided me with the opportunity to learn certain fundamental skills, research, writing, critical thinking, study discipline, and how to absorb knowledge in a didactic learning environment, which are available for me to draw upon when I repeated that undergraduate experience over the course of last year. This is actually a very strong argument, especially against those who think MOOCs should be thought of as providing an effective substitute for a first-time college experience, given that it might be that traditional experience that provides you the tools needed to learn independently through, among other things, massive open courses. I'm going to leave the argument here, since it points to a topic I began discussing on the blog and hope to explore further over the course of this year. Specifically, what are those meta-skills one needs to succeed as an independent learner? For if those are the skills one gains through osmosis by going through 4 years of high-priced college education, perhaps they could be distilled into a curriculum, maybe even a MOOC, that could create more independent learners of any age, able to take advantage of a bounty of free education that is only getting bigger. I just mentioned this year, and as you may guess since you're listening to this podcast 2 weeks after my degree program wrapped, Degree of Freedom is not about to go dark. There's still issues to write about on the blog, albeit probably just a couple times a week versus every day. There's still courses to review via the Degree of Freedom newsletter, not to mention new courses I'd like to take, although at a more leisurely pace, in 2014. And there are more people to interview, which is why the newsletter and podcast will be going into rotation every couple weeks, more or less, over the coming months. I wish I could tell you exactly what's happening next with this project overall, but I can promise you that once I figure that out, you'll be the first to hear about it here on the Degree of Freedom podcast.